Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th Canto, Chapter 1, entitled Genealogical Table of the Daughters of Manu, text number 30. What? No, 29. It's 29, yeah. Maitreya Vacha Ititasya Vacha Srutva Trayaste vidbuddhar sabha. It's not on the board? Oh, 30 is on the board. That's fine. It's like the modern system. Prajahu slakshnaya vacha prahasya tamrisim prabhu. Translation. The great sage Maitreya continued, upon hearing Atri Muni speak in that way, the three great deities smiled and they replied in the following sweet words. Text 30. Deva Uchuvu Yata Kritaste Sankalpo Bhavyam Tenheva Nanyata Satsankalpasya Te Brahman Yadvaya jayati te vayam. That's it. Deva uchu. The demigods replied. Yata as krita done. When we speak word for word, it's not the same as in the verse, because yeah, there is such a thing as called sandhya, where two words are coming together in Sanskrit, and then the last letter changes because it's together with another letter. So here, in this case, the word kritas, and the word for word actually is given as krita. So, very nice. So you have to listen, like when the word for word is spoken, that it's like many times different than what is in the verse. Krita. Done. Te by you. Sankalpaha. See, it's again different, not sankalpo, but sankalpaha. Determination. Bhavyam. To be done. Tena eva. Again different, not tena eva, but it's now broken up in the actual words. Tena eva. By that. Na anyata. It's given nanyata, but in the word for word, na anyata. Not otherwise. Satsankalpasya. One whose determination is never lost. Te. Of you. Brahman, O dear Brahmana, Yat, that which, Vai, certainly, Jayati, meditating, Te, all of them, Vayam, we are. Translation. The three deities told Atri Muni, dear Brahmana, you are perfect in your determination. And therefore, as you have decided, so it will happen, it will not happen otherwise. We are all the same person upon whom you were meditating, and therefore we have all come to you. Purport. Atri Muni unspecifically thought of the personality of Godhead, the Lord of the universe. Although he had no clear idea of the Lord of the universe, nor of his specific form, Mahavishnu, from whose breathing millions of universes emanate, and into whom they are again withdrawn, may be accepted as the Lord of the universe. Garbhadaksaya Vishnu, from whose abdomen sprouted the lotus flower, which is the birthplace of Brahma, may also be considered the Lord of the universe. Similarly, Kshiradaksaya Vishnu, who is the supersoul of all living beings, may also be considered the Lord of the universe. Then, under the order of Kshiradaksaya Vishnu, the Vishnu form within this universe, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, may also be accepted as the lords of the universe. Vishnu is the Lord of the universe because he is maintainer. Similarly, Brahma creates the different planetary systems and the population, so he may also be considered the Lord of the universe. O Lord Shiva, or Lord Shiva, who is ultimately the destroyer of the universe, also may be considered its Lord. Therefore, since Atri Muni did not specifically mention whom he wanted, all three, Brahma, Vishnu, and Lord Shiva, came before him. They said, since you were thinking of having a son exactly like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord of the universe, your determination will be fulfilled. In other words, one's determination is fulfilled according to the strength of one's devotion. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 9.25, Yanti deva vrata devan pitrin yanti priti vrataha. If one is attached to a particular demigod, one is promoted to the abode of that demigod. If one is attached to the pitas or forefathers, one is promoted to their planet. And similarly, if one is attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, one is promoted to the abode of Lord Krishna. Atri Muni had no clear conception of the Lord of the universe. Therefore, the three presiding deities, who are actually the lords of the universe in the three departments of the modes of nature, all came before him. Now, according to the strength of determination for a son, his desire would be fulfilled by the grace of the Lord. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Ginnandana Salakya Shakshura Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So if an ordinary person would be thinking that he wouldn't mind having the Supreme Personality of Godhead as his son, that would not be sufficient. Any of us might be thinking, well, I wouldn't mind having a son just like Krishna. Right? Why not? My little deity. Right? Could be nice. But that doesn't happen. So what happened to Atri Muni was really extraordinary. Atri Muni actually had that desire and was granted that desire. Therefore, we are understanding that Atri Muni was a very saintly personality, very pious. However, we also see that Atri Muni unspecifically thought of the Supreme Lord as the Lord of the universe. He was thinking of the Lord of the universe. And therefore it caused confusion, because there are many different personalities who could be called Lord of the universe. So Atri Muni's aim was unclear. But at the same time, the means by which he tried to establish that, by his extraordinary piety, attracted the mercy of all these living, of all these personalities, of all these great personalities, and they appeared before him. And sanctioned that, yes, okay, that will happen. So we can understand that when such extraordinary pious personalities appear in this world, that these personalities are playing a role in the plan of the Lord. And that therefore the pastime of Atri Muni was particularly desired by the Supreme Lord. And in fact, the Supreme Lord desired it in this way, that Atri Muni was unspecific in his prayer to the Lord of the universe, so that it could clearly be established who is actually the Lord of the universe, the Lord of Lords, Sarka Loka Maheshwaram, who is Maheshwaram. It is said, the ultimate controller or ultimate lord of all the planets within the entire universe. That is the Supreme Lord. So he is Maheshwaram. He is the ultimate lord, the Lord of Lords. That is Lord Krishna, and from him who manifests the Vishnu forms, and they are non-different from the Supreme Lord. Like Prabhupada is giving a lecture, and in the lecture he is saying, don't think that Lord Ramachandra is any less powerful than Lord Krishna. He's equally powerful. He's the same. And then he quotes that verse from Brahma Samhita, Dipachir evahida santram abu pecha dipayate vivritahinu samana dharma yastadrik evahicha vishnu tayur vibhati govindamari purusham tam maham bhajami. which establishes that from one candle so many other candles may be lit, and that each of them are lighting up, right? But that one is the original candle, that is Krishna. But not that the other candles have no potency to spread light. They have the same. And there may be different manifestations of the Supreme Lord. And in these different manifestations, the Lord may either present only part of his energies, or he may present them full. But it's not that we should think that Krishna is all-powerful and Lord Vishnu is not all-powerful. Both are all-powerful. Both are omniscient. Both are the all-powerful Supreme Lord, the self-same Lord, right, who is manifesting himself in different features. It's not that there are two personalities. Although there are two personalities, distinctly different, Krishna and Vishnu, nonetheless, in another sense, Krishna and Vishnu are non-different. Because they are not separated like you and I. Because we are Abhinatvam. Abhinatvam. We are Abhina. We are separated. We are separated parts and parcels. Abhinamsa. We are Amsa. We are part and parcels, but we are separated part and parcels. Yes. So as separated part and parcels of the Lord, we are all distinct from one another. You don't know what I think. I don't know what you think. We have some indications. We look at each other's faces and are reading the expressions, and from that we get some signs, right? We are looking at the hands, and they are also betraying some information. But ultimately we don't read minds. We don't know, because we're separated from each other. But Vishnu Tattva is in one sense all united, and yet also separated, simultaneously one and many. Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. So this is very interesting. So we understand that the Supreme Lord was actually in this pastime establishing himself as the ultimate supreme deity above all other deities. And that is the real purpose of this pastime of Atri Muni. That the Supreme Lord wanted to appear in this world, and that that naturally he would appear as the son of a very pure and exalted personality who was highly pious and who was his instrument. Otherwise the Supreme Lord doesn't become the son of an ordinary person. Right. So therefore, since the Lord agreed to become the son of Atri Muni, we understand that Atri Muni was the instrument of the Lord, and that the Lord, through this pastime, was trying to establish very clearly who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Bhagavatam is very significant like that, that it very clearly establishes that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam does that again and again. And time again establishes Lord Krishna as superior over personalities like Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. And also makes it very clear that it's not a matter of making a choice, or that there's even that, or that Krishna is the supreme, but that Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva come very close and are almost the supreme personality of Godhead. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. Although there is a vast distance between us, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, we are totally insignificant in comparison to them. There is still an unlimitedly greater distance between Lord Krishna and Lord Vishnu and Shiva and Brahma. They may be so powerful, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, but their power is equally insignificant as our power is in front of the Supreme Lord, who is unlimitedly powerful. And therefore we see many pastimes where this is displayed. We can think how Lord Brahma went to see Lord Krishna in Dwarka and was stopped by the doorkeeper and said that, I would like to see Lord Vishnu. Said, who can I say that has come? Who can I say? Lord Brahma has come. And the doorkeeper asks, which Lord Brahma? Which Lord Brahma? The Lord Brahma. I'm Lord Brahma. What do you mean, which Lord Brahma? Right, gosh. You know. So that bewildered Lord Brahma. So finally, he was saying, okay, tell him the Brahma with four heads. That really made his mind wonder, are there more? Are there others? And then Lord Krishna arranged it. That millions of Brahmas appeared there in Dwarka, and some with millions of head, thousands of head, hundreds of head, and they were all bowing down to Lord Krishna. And as they were bowing down to Lord Krishna, they were all wearing beautiful jewelry and beautiful helmets, nicely decorated. And with these helmets, as they were bowing down, they're all touching the ground. And all these heads of all these Brahmas at the same time made a clap louder than thunder. And that clap smashed the false ego of Lord Brahma. Right. So like that, Krishna made many arrangements to show Lord Brahma how much superior he was. He also made arrangements with Lord Shiva. Like Lord Shiva was very interested in the illusory potency of the Lord. So, and how it worked. So, Lord Krishna appeared, or agreed to appear, before him also as the form of Mohini Murti. Lord Shiva wanted to see that Mohini Murti form. But when, once that Mohini Murti form appeared before Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva, who is totally self-controlled and totally not agitated by the three modes of material nature, suddenly lost it, totally lost it, became mad and ran after this form of this woman, Mohini Murti, who was irresistible and just embraced her. And even before anything happened, he had already lost semen also in the whole situation. Right? So totally out of control. Yes, and that happened, then he came to his senses, right, by the arrangement of the Lord. And the Lord again withdrew that form of Mohini Murti. And Lord Shiva realized how he was not as transcendental as he thought he was. So all these pastimes are showing the how the Supreme Lord is by far superior. We also know the incident where Lord Shiva at times is defending various demons. And in the case of Banasura, who was a very dear devotee of Lord Shiva, Banasura had 1,000 arms. And he used all these 1,000 arms to drum while Lord Shiva was dancing in ecstasy. So Lord Shiva regularly dances in 1,000 arms, so it's like his favorite drummer, right? And very dear, his dear devotee, who really drummed so nice. And then, somehow or other, that devotee lost the grace of Lord Krishna, and there was a fight. And then Lord Shiva took the side of Banasura to protect him. And there was a great fight. And it said that Lord Shiva released this weapon known as the Shiva Dwara. And this weapon was the ultimate weapon, the weapon of ultimate heat. Ultimate heat. Right? So what can you, it was like a fever. Right? Like a burning fever, just burning and burning and hotter and hotter and hotter and just emanating more and more heat like that. Right? And Lord Krishna sent the Narayan Jwara, ultimate cold. Right? And gradually, right, the heat, the deity personified, that weapon had a personal form. And the Shiva Dwara in his personal form began to feel colder and colder. And he was, at one point, he was cooling down, he was freezing. He was freezing. So the personification of ultimate heat was freezing before the Narayan Dwara, saying, please, before I freeze, you know, right? And surrendered. Right? So there Lord Shiva also had to withdraw and could not defeat Lord Krishna. So again and again, It is clearly established. Of course, we also understand that within every universe there is a Brahma, and within any universe there is a Lord, is a form of Lord Shiva, right? But Lord Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead who exists eternally in the spiritual world. So how can it compare? Some small personalities within the universe who are doing their things, and Lord Mahavishnu, who's outside and from the poreholes of his body, appear unlimited universes. And that Mahavishnu is only a partial expansion of Lord Krishna, who is unlimited in his qualities, his energies, and so on. So, as to see it all in perspective, right? So Srimad Bhagavatam places it all in perspective. How these various personalities exist, and at the same time, how Krishna is the supreme. And it's important. It's important because without understanding that there are demigods, without understanding that there are everywhere in the universe superior personalities who are dealing with different aspects, and without developing a mood of respect and dependence on superior personalities, we become impersonalists and we become envious of Krishna. Right? So we need to, at every step in our life, accept superiors. So you can see how our Western world has become contaminated because we got rid of that concept. Right? Basically, we got rid of the concept of superior. Right? You are no better than me. Right? Just because you wear a crown. Right? You may have a crown, and that's okay. You know, but that doesn't make you any better than me. Right? Because we're all equal. Everybody is equal, ultimately. In the ultimate sense, everyone is equal. And this is a great realization. Yes. So that's, in one sense, it's true. We also find it in Bhagavad Gita. Even in the spiritual sense, we find that everyone is ultimately all equal. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmana gavini hastini sunichaiva svapakacha pandita samadarshinaha. The wise and learned person sees all equal, whether it is learned brahmana, elephant, or a dog eater, all he sees as equal. In other words, all the external differences actually don't matter, all are equal. Yes, but then we go one step further, right? That although we are all equal on the platform of the spirit soul, every spirit soul has its own relationship with Krishna. And therefore, in that spiritual sense, some are closer and some are further away from Krishna, some are more intimate with Krishna, and therefore everyone, in that sense, is not equal in terms of his relationship with Krishna. In terms of being spirit soul, we are all equal. But in terms of our relationship with Krishna, there's a hierarchy. There is a hierarchy. And that is very important. And therefore, in spiritual life, right, that is to be recognized, that we have superiors, and we have to get used to that, because we just gave up that concept. As soon as we left our parents, we thought, okay, that's over now. No more superiors, right? I'm as good as anyone else, and nobody can tell me anything. That became our mood. But in spiritual life, it is different. So one has to make that mental adjustment to work under the guidance of superior persons and to recognize that. And it takes time, actually, to learn how to do that proper, to learn the etiquette. We may externally accept someone as superior, but we may still not fully deal properly, right? And have the proper attitude of dependence. In Vedic culture, there was dependence, and we may be very respectful in terms of etiquette. Yes, please accept my respects, and please accept my obeisances, and yes, please accept this title. But at the same time, I don't agree with you, right? So, but that is not possible, right? Because one cannot so much publicly disagree with a superior One can disagree with a superior, but only in a respectful mode. It is stated, Narahari Shakar is stating that even when the guru is acting inappropriate against the scriptures or against the injunctions of the acharyas, a disciple may with argument and reason present before that person that this is not appropriate. But it must be done with etiquette. So it must always be done in the spirit of you please forgive me, but what you just have been explaining is causing a lot of confusion to my mind. Because I have also heard from other sources contradictory information. So now I do not know how to reconcile the two. So could you please clarify it for me? And that would be appropriate. But if one would say, it's wrong what you're saying, because here and there it says something else, that would be totally out of line, totally inappropriate. So therefore it is very refined to actually deal with superiors. It is, and many times one cannot even point out the fault to a superior, but rather should find another person of equal status and go through that person and let that person deal with the superior person. So the principles of etiquette are refined and are recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he was in Jagannath Puri, had requested Sanatan Goswami to stay there with him. But at the time, Sanatan Goswami was having these sores, these horrible sores, because he had been drinking this bad water in Jharkhanda. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would every day come visit Haridas Thakur, and that's where Sanatan Goswami was staying. So he would also see Sanatan Goswami every day. And when he would meet him, then so many times, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would just embrace Sanatan Goswami. Just embrace him. And then all the pus and all the juice coming out of these sores would touch the body of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Sanatan Goswami was thinking, it's just, I am just offense personified, and every day I make more and more offenses, right, by touching the body of the Lord with my horrible body. I mean, I've got to go. I can't stay here. So then he discussed it with Jagannanda Pandit, who said, well, maybe you should go to Vrindavan. Maybe that's a good idea, right? After all, Vrindavan is the holy dham, and maybe that's it's a very good. And then later, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu found out about that, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, who is this Jaga? He didn't even call him Jagadananda. He said, who does this Jaga think he is? Right? Who does he think he is to instruct you? Jaga is just a boy. Right? Jaga is just a boy. Whereas you are a very learned person. Even I will take advice from you. So who's Jaga to give you advice? Right? And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then said very solemnly, he said, I'll never be pleased with the service of anyone who does not follow the principles of Sadachar, of Vaishnava etiquette. So this is such a strong statement, such a heavy statement there in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where it feels like, who, you know? Lord Chaitanya speaks like that, as a very strong warning. So, of course, Jagadananda himself was, although junior to Sanatan Goswami, a great liberated devotee who could deliver the entire universe, right? So not just an ordinary person at all. And still, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu held up this concept of etiquette. So this is definitely a principle that we must learn better how to deal with superior persons. So accepting the demigods is also part of that, that there are many superior personalities within the universe, superior to us, and we depend on them. We depend on the rain and the sun, and yesterday we discussed how that has a big influence on it. Like here in Holland, you know, it's a country where slowly you become depressed. You know, what's wrong with you? I don't know. I don't know. What you want to do? I don't know. What you want to eat? I don't know. Is there anything you want to do? I don't know. When you get in that kind of mode, the I don't know mode, right? How did it happen that you came into this state of mind? I don't know. Is there anything you know? No, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know. So, it's simply the clouds. The effect of the clouds. It happens in November. It starts in November in this country, right? In November it hits, you know, and you get this feeling like, you know, I don't know. No, everyone gets it, right? It's just the clouds. And as soon as the sun shines, you think, well, life is not that bad, you know. That's all right. It's not that bad, right? We definitely are affected by these things, right? And all that is controlled by the demigods. Yes. I mean, it's like we totally depend on the demigods. They control the weather. They control so many natural circumstances. Actually, they are very much involved with our life. Many functions in our body are controlled by the demigods and the devas. So we should understand that they are superiors. And that therefore they must be treated as superiors. But yet, worship and devotional service, especially, we reserve for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One time we had to go, when I was involved in the Mayapur Samadhi construction, there was a famous temple in South India which had been made by a group of carvers, right? And it was all in carved stone and it was very intricate carving. And we were thinking of engaging the same people who had carved that temple. So we were supposed to go and look at that temple. So we went to the temple, but it was a Durga temple. And the people, the temple was full with people and they were all having their devotion, their devotional songs for the deity, etc. But it was all for material gain, right? So he's just watching that, you know, it's like, And then they came, you want some prasad, right? I said, no, that's not what we call prasad, right? Because that doesn't liberate you from material desire. That doesn't bring light to the heart that burdens the heart, right? That burdens the heart by reinforcing the material desire. Who wants that kind of prasad? We want prasad that is a real prasad, right? Prakrista rupena siddhati. We want that prasad, prakrista rupena, that in its full-fledged, it is the full-fledged form of that which can satisfy siddhati. So it leaves you fully satisfied, takes away all burden from the heart and lifts us up and makes us all light. That's prasad, right? Not that other, whatever it is, don't give that to us. No, thank you. Let's get out of here. Right? It was even difficult to stay and to watch the architecture. Right? It's such an intense atmosphere. Let's get out of here. You know, we can't handle this. Right? So, because something was missing, the understanding that real devotional service can only be for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That was missing. Yeah. But maybe we were missing the attitude of dealing with demigods and offering respects to demigods because we're not used to demigods. Okay, that there is a God, and that we kind of have always been wondering about, right? Is there one or is there not one? That was always the question. So that's not a new thing to us. Is there a God? Is there not a God? And finally we came to the conclusion, there is. And then he's Krishna. Okay, that's Krishna, but he's the same God that we always knew, the same one God, but now the difference is we know he's Krishna. But all these demigods were never part of the picture. Not part of our psychological picture. That's the point I'm talking about. That now suddenly we have to, in our psychology, make an adjustment to put all these demigods in there. There was already a spot for the Supreme Lord. That spot was just, okay, there were question marks surrounding the spot. Does he exist? Does he not exist? Or who is he? Right? But okay, that question's answered, and he just took his took the seat that was already there in our whole thought pattern. But the demigods were not in the program. Right? And suddenly we have to write them into the program. So it's like a whole adjustment, big adjustment. So it's difficult because on the one hand we have these demigods and we have to accept them as superior personalities. And on the other hand we have all kinds of warnings that we should not worship them and that we should be reserved. And so it's a complex thing to actually deal with. You know, how do you emotionally deal with these demigods, right? So we have to accept them as superior. But we should not like really develop devotion for them, you know. So it's difficult, right? Because we're just trying to open our heart and be devotees. And then here is like picture of Lord Brahma, and we're supposed to be respectful, but we're not supposed to like, you know, just pour our whole heart out there, because then, you know, boom, it may just go too far, and we may just all develop too much devotion, right? And we're not supposed to be. So it's a complex thing to. And we're not used to, as I said, in our psychology to the demigods, so we have to work out our relationship. Whereas someone who grew up in a Vedic context, he has that relationship of actually genuinely appreciating the demigods and yet clearly understanding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, therefore, it's a tricky thing. We accept the demigods as our superiors, but we also know that they are having mixed devotion. Right? We know that they are described as very exalted and devotees of the Lord, but that they're having mixed devotion. So again, another confusing element, right? They're superiors, but they're having mixed devotion. So it's like, again, a mental thing. I mean, how much can you really accept them as superiors, right? When they're having mixed devotion, because now we are the movement of pure devotion, right? So again, some touchy thing there with the demigods. Right? But okay, we can kind of look at that situation like an uncle, right? We have some uncles, and they are our superiors, right? They are by far our superiors. They've always been, you know, our superiors. But yet, it's not so that the uncles are in all aspects perfect and complete, right? And all their opinions are totally right. So we can compare it to that situation. Like, they are superiors in just by their birth and by their bodies and by their experience. They are superiors. What can you do? You know, your uncle is 25, 30 years older than you, and he knows more than you. In many ways, that comes out, you know. I mean, that experience, you can't write it off and just say, I'm equal to you. No, in many ways, he's superior because he has that 30 years of experience. But still, in some ideas, the uncle may not be the perfect person. So, in that way, we can also look at the demigods and see they are superior. They have taken superior birth. They have superior facilities, superior intelligence, superior training, superior memories. They have superior powers. Our powers are nothing compared to the powers of the demigods. Their whole world is so superior. Yesterday, we used the example of that Brahmana who had the perfect memory. And who, although he didn't speak English, he could remember the conversation of the argument that two Englishmen had and perfectly repeat it in front of a judge, although he didn't understand a word. Right? So, what a memory. Right? And we were just for a moment dwelling on, imagine you would have a memory like that. How much information could you just access, and how authorized would your statements be? Right? So the demigods, they all have very powerful memories, and they have huge, huge sources of information. Right? How powerful are they? How easy can they actually judge situation in the context of knowledge in scripture? And we are trying to figure it out, and you know, it's like you haven't got it fully right, and like, right? There were so many details of the philosophy that are difficult and always like controversial and complex, and we're trying to figure out. The demigods know how the universe works, no problem. You know, they they just go and check it out, right? They regularly fly around Mount Meru. They don't need some sort of computer-generated column, you know, that stands there like that, right? And like, you know, and some a few disks there on the computer screen with at the end simulated Loka-Loka mountains, right? No, if the demigods want to know the Loka-Loka mountains, they just go there. Let's go, and let's go and have a little excursion to the Loka-Loka mountains, you know, huh? We can, you know, maybe go to the Ardennes, right, if we want to go to the hills, but that's as far as our mountain excursions go, right? Himalayas, if you're really adventurous, right? But there it stops, you know. But they go, they can just go to the Loka-Loka mountains and all that, right? So imagine the power of the demigods. Imagine the intellectual capacity they have. How great are the thoughts the demigods can have compared to our limited little world, you know. It's our tiny little brains in our tiny little world, and we're struggling and trying to, what was that again? What was I thinking of? Oh yeah, oh God, you know. Oh yeah, yeah, let me write it down. Okay, yeah, then, so many. How many ideas do we have that just get lost? Do you have a two? What was that again? What was it, you know? I had a really good idea. There are people in the business world that they have either a dictaphone, even in ISKCON actually, Bhaktipur Sattamaraj, the last year, was walking around with this little dictaphone. And I said, well, you're really getting high tech, Swami, right? You know, no, coming from the Orissa village, and now always having a little dictaphone. He was saying, well, like, you know, but I have many ideas, and then I forget them, you know, I forget them. So whenever I have an idea, I speak it in the dictaphone. Yeah. And there are many people in the world who are using dictaphones or notepads or, you know, handheld computers for these purposes, right? So, with these kind of detailed descriptions, I'm trying to paint the contrast between us and the demigods, and really try to kind of elaborate and make it more visual to us how they are superior persons, and how we should accept them as superior persons, and how we can understand that they really are greater than we are, but yet. Whatever may be in their greatness, right, they are not having the greatness in devotion to Krishna that we find amongst the pure devotee acharyas in our sampradaya. So we are following the footsteps of the pure devotee acharyas. But we truly recognize the demigods as superiors and appreciate them as superior beings and are respectful to them. And yet, we are rendering our service to them and again to the Supreme Lord and kind of also with the demigods, knowing that the demigods certainly will be satisfied. My dear Lord Brahma, thank you for all your blessings. I'm sure that you will be very pleased if I dedicate all my energy to the service of Krishna. So please forgive me if I'm not offering any further worship to your lotus feet. But accept all respects. That kind of a mood should be there, right? My dear Lord Shiva, now you are inconceivably powerful and inconceivably great. I cannot even imagine, Lord Shiva, right, who you are. That, but when it comes to offering worship, I have no time left because I don't have enough time actually for the worship of Krishna. I'm always falling short. So there's not a moment to spare. Rather, I need more time to serve Krishna. So please forgive me if I do not have time to render any worship, but let me just continue my service to Krishna. So in this spirit, the devotee is respectful and appreciative of the demigods, and yet knowing very well that they are serving the same master we do, and that ultimately we're all working together. We are all working together. We here in this temple are all working together. If we're not all working together, then we're in Maya, then we are missing the point, right? Because we are working all together for the sake of glorifying and pleasing Krishna. And the demigods are also working for that purpose. So we're all working together for the pleasure of Krishna. And therefore, the demigods certainly will be pleased with our efforts. So in this way, what I'm saying is not revolutionary, but I was trying to emotionally make it easier to deal with demigod worship, right? Because I have been thinking about it for myself, how to relate to this, how to deal with this, right? And here in the West, it seems to be not such an issue, because we only speak about demigods in Bhagavatam classes, and, you know, otherwise not so often. But in India, or in dealing with Indians, it becomes acute. It becomes really acute, you know. So many times I'm invited in Indian gatherings, and they want me to eat something which is offered too, you know. And Swamiji is not in the position to take. He's only taking water outside. The Swami is only taking the Mandir Prasad. So many things, you know, I have to do to get out of this. Yeah? It's like really hard sometimes. Really, really hard. Because the people really want you to take it. And if you don't do it, you know, when some Indian Mataji has cooked for you with all her devotion and her whole heart, and you don't want to take, you're like her own son. You're rejecting her as a mother. You're not accepting her to become your mother. Right? It's not, you're not eating. No. I'm not hungry. No, it's okay. You know, would you like to eat some? No, I'm not really hungry. Okay. It's not like that. She's your mother, and you've just rejected her as a mother. You have not become the son. My God, what misery. So, very, very difficult, you know. Then at least take some fruits, but sometimes you don't even want to take the fruits, right? Yeah. Then they come from the altar of the demigods, puja, right? I ain't gonna take no fruit that has been offered to a demigod, no way. Pranams fruit, right? I fold my hands to that fruit, but I'm not taking it, no way. Because we cannot take prasadam from the demigods, because it has not been offered in the spirit of removing all material desires from the heart. Rather the opposite. So how can we do anything that that increases the material desires in our hearts? No way. Also not to please some Indian Mataji or some Indian gentleman. I'm so sorry. It cannot be done. But it's difficult. So one is confronted with it at times, and very much. And in India itself, the This demigod worship is there all the time. It is totally part of society. And it's totally out of proportion. It's grown out of proportion. One of the missions of this movement is to purify the standards of demigod worship. That has to be done. Just as one of our missions is to drive out impersonalism. Right? Another mission is to give demigod worship its proper place. And as I was trying to illustrate, the Indian or Hindu, let's call it Hindu, the Hindu approach to demigod worship may not be appropriate. But we also still have to learn how to actually respect the demigods and how to deal with the demigods. So in this way, I know we are not usually lying awake, you know, thinking, what about my relationship with the demigods? And I really have to work on this. This is an important thing in my spiritual life. And if I don't work this out, I'll probably, really won't make much advancement. But it is also something to give some thought to. Well, not that it is in the foreground of our thoughts, but we have to figure it out. It is something that also is part of the total vision of Krishna consciousness, because the demigods cannot be overlooked. They are definitely part of the full picture. Okay, so with that, I will stop. And if there are any questions or comments. Well, there are a few in Vrindavan. There are a few lingams which are particularly installed with Lord Shiva as the protector of the Dham. Right? Those are that prasadam can be taken as prasadam from Shiva as a devotee. Yeah. Personally, I will not take that prasadam. I will respect that prasadam. Right? But it is Shiva prasadam. But there we say at least Lord Shiva is purely being worshipped in the mood as a pure devotee of the Lord. Yeah. But still, it is said we should only take that prasadam which first was offered to Krishna and then offered to the demigods. Yeah. So whether it is in Vrindavan or not, it may be certainly tinged with a touch of the Dham, you know, and it may have some special of Shakti from Krishna in there and some mercy of Krishna in there, because it is in the Holy Dham. Anything in the Holy Dham is that touch of Krishna. But if it's offered to a demigod, I don't think we should take it. It would not be, because there may still be, we may develop some fruitive desire through that. That risk is there, so wouldn't advise anyone to take that. Be respectful. Only pure Krishna or Vishnu prasadam is the prasadam we take, even in the Holy Dham. But it's true, anything, if somebody cooks in the Holy Dham, it does have that special mercy, and sometimes it is said, therefore, everything in the Holy Dham is anyway prasad. It's so powerful, the Dham, that if anybody cooks anything in the Dham, it has a very powerful purifying effect, and the mercy of Krishna is just there because it's from the Dham. Anything from the Dham, right? Anything from the Dham is just full of transcendental power. But if it's been offered to the demigods, then one can pay obeisances to it, one can fold his hands to it, but one should not take it, one should not eat it. That's all. And whatever mercy of Krishna is in there, there's also the offering to the demigods in there. But if it was first offered to Krishna, then it's simply offering Krishna Prasadam to the demigods. So then it's Krishna Prasadam which has been honored by the demigods. That's another thing. That may be taken. That may be taken.
And it's there like in Jagannath Puri, there are all the Krishna's offerings to Jagannath.
Yeah, that may be taken. Not all prasadam, but some prasadam. They have so much, you know. I mean, it's so offered in so many different ways. Some things I think are not even offered at all. But they come from Jagannath Puri Dham, so they're still prasadam. You know? Some things are just cooked there. You know, many things are cooked. It's not all Mahaprasadam what comes out of the Jagannath temple. There's a whole lot of just what we call prasadam. I mean, it's not that everything has been on the plate of the Lord. Everything you get, you know, you get all this Mahaprasadam from Puri temple. Yeah, it means prasadam coming out of the temple. Not that everything was on the altar. Not like that. It has potency, without a doubt. Yes.
And Maharaj, about like, if you need some Lakshmi, like to go into India or something like this, and you see you need some, like, yeah, I mean, we have, like, we have very, the Avalon chances, like, Lord Mercy. Can we approach the Mother Lakshmi, or we, like,
no. Krishna? No. No, you just don't even have to approach anyone. You know that Krishna knows. Krishna knows already. So you don't have to like, Krishna, are you hearing me? I need to go to India really bad, you know. Can you help me? No need. He already knows. And you don't have to approach Mother Lakshmi. You should just try to get the Lakshmi together yourself somehow or other. And if Krishna wants you to go, he'll surely help you to go. And if he doesn't want you to go, he'll surely make it impossible for you to go. That's all. Yeah. So it's not an excuse. So don't look for reasons to worship the demigods. But we're seeing that the acharyas are sometimes taking blessings from the demigods. Huh? What's the Saraswati verse at the beginning? Okay, I'll have to start again. Narayanam Skrichanaram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirajit. So here we are asking benedictions to Saraswati, right? So it's like this is for reciting Bhagavatam, we're also asking benedictions for Saraswati, and we're seeing that Vaishnava Acharyas are asking benedictions of Saraswati. Right? You see that Lotion Das Thakur and the Chaitanya Mangal is asking benedictions of Saraswati. So how can we do this? No. Okay, we're asking blessings. That's all. But don't get in the habit of asking blessings. Not required. Prabhupada didn't teach it to us. Prabhupada never said to the devotees, you should regularly ask blessings to the demigods. But we see that Vaishnav Acharyas have done so. And there are some verses in Bhagavatam doing so. But then Prabhupada didn't introduce it for us. So don't start it then. So don't get into it, because we may be too unbalanced and too inexperienced in dealing with the demigods to do that. Yeah. So don't start, oh dear Lakshmi, please bless this collection. Oh dear Saraswati, please bless this study. And Durga Devi, while you're blessing, you may as well bless this day. And Ganesh, please bless my heart and my pocket as well. And, you know, so let's not get into all this. That's just only Krishna. Just, and Krishna, you're not supposed to ask him for anything. You're only supposed to offer him something. So give up this, we have to give up this mentality to ask for things. Anyabhidasita sunyam. Any other? Taking shelter means that, not that Krishna has to provide what you think you need, but that rather that you should take what he wants to give. He wants to give you pure devotion, and you think he should give you money. So no. Not that Krishna has to provide you what you think you need. No, you should provide Krishna what he thinks you should provide. And that's given, right, in the scripture. That's it. Anyway, for all of us, I'm saying you, but all of us are in the same boat. You're just more honest. If we need help or something. I mean, we are like dying and Krishna help, you know, I mean, Krishna save me. I'll never be sinful again, but please don't let me die of this terrible fever like that. Help. Yeah, we can take shelter of Krishna in fear. So even the cowherd boys were asking Krishna for help in a dangerous situation. So that in danger, one may ask Krishna to be saved. That's allowed. That's natural. That's not condemned. That's not the same as, my Lord, won't you buy me that Mercedes Benz?
I heard that the Lugana Maharaj was praying at the centennial Prabhupada for a lot of money.
I don't know. You ask him. He never told me. No, I have no idea.
And if you offer Boga to demigod, would you understand it? Like if we offer it to Prabhupada,
To Krishna. No, that's not our position, because the demigod is not directly our spiritual master, right? So in one sense, as we are offering to Prabhupada, it goes through Lord Brahma, because he's in our sampradaya. But we are not offering to Lord Brahma, and then thinking he's our agent to Krishna, and actually I'm offering to Krishna through the demigod. No, it's not our business. Because one must go through the current link. So that would be stepping over and would not be in accordance with that injunction. One can only offer to his own spiritual master. One cannot even skip out his own spiritual master and think, I'll offer to Prabhupada. Yeah? If one is a grand disciple, one cannot just think, well, I'll offer it through Prabhupada. No, one has to offer it through his own spiritual master. And always say the pranam mantra of his own spiritual master, otherwise one's offering is incomplete. Of course, sometimes we only have a picture of Prabhupada, that may be. But then at least in the mind, we should still offer it through our own spiritual master. Otherwise the offering is incomplete. So, always goes up through our spiritual master. It's the only way to make an offering.
And you're saying that the demigods, they have seen Meru and the Bhumanga and so forth. So now, the other day we were discussing that in the Varaha's pastime, it was described that Varaha took the whole Bhumanga down into the ocean. Well, Prabhupada describes it. It's just the earth plan. So, see the whole picture. So.
I don't know. Maybe Prabhupada didn't consider it so significant. You know, I mean, we see so many details sometimes that are just not discussed, you know, in descriptions, right? Because Prabhupada was not so concerned with that aspect. Prabhupada was more concerned with the maybe with another aspect of the pastime, which he took out as the essential aspect. Now, see, if you take the pastime, you can take your zoom lens and you can go in on a particular detail. But maybe Prabhupada didn't address that detail, but just took the more main principle about the relationship between the demon and the Supreme Lord and the different emotions and exchanges that came out, because ultimately it doesn't matter. Ultimately it's a detail, whether it was Bhumandala or whether it was Earth or whether whatever it was that fell into the ocean, or almost or whatever, whether it fell in the ocean, whether it didn't fall in the ocean, and all that, you know, ultimately doesn't change anything about the exchanges of rasa that were there, or of perverted rasa. Right, or the relationship that existed between the Supreme Lord and that particular personality. So therefore, and that's the essence, right? That's the essence, obviously. So sometimes sometimes we see that the acharyas even don't discuss a particular detail, and then later we read somewhere else, some more details about it, right? And that seemed to be different. So hey, we never, like it says, you know, Krishna has taken birth in Mathura, right? But you and I and Avaduta, we know, and maybe even Madhu, right, that there is also a mention that Krishna took birth in Vrindavan. And that actually Yasoda gave birth to twins, and that later Krishna from Vrindavan just merged with the Krishna from Mathura and they became one, right? So that we don't read in Bhagavatam. So, you know, like, so we may say, this is wrong, you know, this is wrong. Krishna took birth. No, he did not. Krishna actually appeared in Vrindavan. Right? No, this is just another level, right, which is sometimes brought out and sometimes not. So in the same way, Bhumandala or the earth or what? You know, I don't think one can possibly from that. One must be careful not to fall in the trap to impose through our logic all kinds of limitations on Prabhupada. We should be careful with that. We can't do that. Because once we start doing that, then we don't know anymore what is right and what is wrong and all that in this regard. You know what I mean? Then Vaishnavira Kriya Vikyana Bhujaya, we have to be careful. We should step back and say, I can't understand, you know, this point, that's all. But we can't second guess what was the reason that Prabhupada did not comment. So then we come on the slippery slide. And ultimately, we fall prey to thinking that we know more than Prabhupada did. We begin to minimize Prabhupada. That's dangerous. Yes, exactly. No, we cannot. I think we have to. First of all, we have to become strong in our vision. So we have to develop some vision of what are we actually doing in our life and what are we trying to achieve. And then we're seeing like, yes, but where am I at? You know, I want to go there, but where am I actually? And then we see, I want to go to pure devotee, but I am actually totally full of material desires. Now what to do? I cannot just be pure devotee overnight. So, I want to lift 150 kilos, but I can only lift 25. What to do? Practice every day. Start lifting the 25, start lifting 35, start lifting 50 every day, and you know, practice and practice, and one day you will be the weightlifter, and you too will lift 150 kilos. Right? Rip a phone book in half, right? Or lift a plank with 17 people sitting on it, right? On your feet, and all those things you see in the circus, right? One man, right? You see that. It's all practice. So, that's why there is a whole system of sadhana and slowly building it up. So we're trying to build up our spiritual strength. And we're not trying to jump, we're trying to go gradual. So we don't have to give up the material desires altogether, but we have to purify the material desires and say some material desires cannot be. Right? Some things we have to give up, but then we have the right to express material desires in authorized ways, in purifying ways, like that. Not that everyone has to give up the world. And this, if you want to go really, really deep on this matter, then you have to get personal and specific. And then class is no longer the forum of it. You know, then you have to start taking, if you want to go really into an answer that is even more relevant, then you just have to put your cards on the table. Right? And that's not the forum here, I'm saying, but that's how it works next. Cards on the table, and then we'll say, yes, this card has to go. Those cards, okay, they can stay in the game for the time being. And gradually some cards have to get out of the game. Like that. Or we can discuss, say, sorry, but this card can't go. It really can't go. Then it's like, but the consequences of it will be this and this. And then if the card really can't go, then for the time being, at least, try and do these and these things. So there's always a prescription. Like that. The more we hold on to this desire and that desire, the slower we will go. That's, of course, the fact. It slows you down, these material desires. But anyway, don't get discouraged. We could just, gradually advance by doing devotional service. That's always there. If we're not so strong, do more devotional service. You won't lose, That will give us the strength. So just, we have material desires, okay, but let's at least always do some devotional service. That will help. Then it will come. Yeah. So that's natural. Me too. If I don't have enough money, I also start to worry about money. I also need money, right? I think everybody needs enough money, right? And for some, enough is more. And for others, enough is less, right? So if enough means for you a lot of money, then it becomes maybe time to make an adjustment. But otherwise, if enough money just means a normal quantity to survive, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. No problem at all. And, whether you want a little more than somebody else, that's okay. I just presented my accounts, and it's about 16,000 euros last year, my income. Little less than last year. Last year was maybe about 18 or so. Year. Yeah, so I'm a poor man, not so rich. I'm under the minimum wages. But that's enough to survive. So you have to also say, I don't know how much you need to survive. But you know what I'm saying? So it's okay. We can have our money. We can have our place where we live. We need It's a fact. If our basic facility is not there, we get disturbed and it gets difficult to practice spiritual life. So we can have the basic facility. But we should not overexpend on that and spend so much time to make it bigger and better and still a little better, and then there's no more time and energy for spiritual life. We should try and solve it as simple as we can so we have time left for spiritual life. Practical. You don't have to perform austerities. You just live normal, not too extreme, not overly austere, and chant Hare Krishna and go on. That's okay. That's bona fide. Manu, any question? No. Comment. Okay. Then we'll stop. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.